and welcome to the Trev and Ben podcast. Hello, Ben.
Hello, how are you? Oh, dear. Not bad.
Well, it's just another one of them weeks, is it? I've been out driving, you know, testing my eyesight.
Good.
I'm going to be honest with you, Ben. My morale is pretty low. I think I've just had enough of people. I've had enough of people lying to us. I've had enough of the world being in a shithole at the moment. You know, everything that's going on in America. I mean, that's, my God, what is going on there.
That's so sad.
So I'm trying to cheer myself up here, Ben. I'm trying to cheer myself up.
Okay.
You know, I think the world's getting to me. I wrote to my MP this week. That got a lot off my chest. Yeah, I wrote to my MP about Dominic Cummings. I'm waiting for a response.
Still no reply, no?
Well, I only sent it on Friday, so
Fair enough. I'll give him time.
I think I was pretty clear in my thinking. I won't share the whole email with you, but I'll share with you just a paragraph.
Oh, lovely.
If you'd like.
So yes, please.
I wrote, as much as I am angry that Mr. Cummings drove to Durham, what angers me more is the disdain with which he and this government have treated us with their explanations. It appears to me that they assume the British public are stupid and will blindly accept that A, the rules were always open to interpretation and common sense, when that was by no means the message that we were given. In fact, if I remember correctly, Mr. Johnson instructed us to stay at home, to not drive anywhere, and to not visit any other household, especially if you or any member of your household were showing symptoms of the virus. B, the ludicrous and fantastical explanation about driving to a castle to test your eyesight. The insult to the intelligence of voters in this country is astounding. To then have it followed up by Mr. Gove, Michael Gove, who is a twat of the highest order, saying he too had driven...
Sorry, was that an ad-lib or is that part of your letter?
No, that's not part. I wish I'd put that in. Saying he too had driven to test his eyesight shows the lengths and lies this government are prepared to tell and go to protect one of their own. That's just one paragraph of my letter to my MP.
Stern stuff.
So I'm looking forward to my response from my local MP.
Yeah, well, please, you know, if you can, share some of the response with us when you finally, if you get one, that is.
Yeah, but I think I will, because another member of my family has written to him and already had a response. So I think I will get a response. I don't know what he can say to me apart from, yeah, I know. I mean, he's a Labour MP, so he's not going to support the government, but I don't know what else he can do. It just felt good to get it out. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, get it off your chest.
Yeah, I thought, I know this ain't going to make any difference, but let's just get it out there.
I'd be really interested to see the comparison between the response you get and the response your family member got and how just generic cut and paste it is.
That's an interesting point. Yeah, I'll be good to look at that. So yeah, that's it's all been bothering me this week. I've been in a foul mood all week.
Well, it seems to me that they've come up with this idea now that it's use your common sense, so that you and I can be in exactly the same conundrum. I can choose to go outside and do something and you can choose to be safe and stay indoors. And if anything bad happens to me, then the government can say, well, we didn't mean to use that kind of common sense. We mean the kind that Trev used.
But it's retrospective.
It's bizarre.
It's retrospective. It's not even like from now. It's like, oh no, we meant that from the start. No, we won't go into it again. We did enough on it last week, but it's just infuriating. And of course, since we recorded last week's podcast, we had that press conference from Dominic Cummings where he was about 40 minutes late. I'm presuming there was a lot of traffic from Durham. and he just sat there and gave an hour and a half of wank.
He really did. And just when you thought you couldn't get any angrier, then the whole revelation about driving to a castle to test your eyesight, which I'm delighted to see that excellent TV shows such as Have I Got News For You have royally ripped the piss out of him for.
Yeah, and I discovered that Barnard Castle is a slang term.
Yes, it is.
What does it mean?
Well, in English slang, Barnard Castle means poor excuse.
I mean, you couldn't make it up, could you?
You couldn't write
you
it, honestly.
You couldn't make it up. Fantastic. The other thing I learned this week, just while we're on politicians, right, while a lot of people are struggling financially through the coronavirus crisis, our former Prime Minister, I mean, just when we thought we couldn't have a worse Prime Minister than Theresa May, look at what we've ended up with. I found out that our former Prime Minister, Theresa May, has earned £160,000 in cancellation fees for speeches she was supposed to have given during this period of time.
I mean, the brass neck of it all.
I hope she's giving all of that to a charity. So I don't know whether she is or not. So I'm not, until I find out, I will reserve judgment.
I imagine she's can't believe her luck. She's not have to do any work. She's 160 grand. She's probably running through a field of wheat as we speak.
Oh, no, she's not that naughty anymore.
Oh, she's not. Oh,
no,
she's
no, that was the, okay. That was just the naughtiest thing she'd ever done.
Oh, those were during the rebellious years.
Yeah, those were back in the days when, oh, you know, most MPs were smoking pot. You know, yeah. They were fucking about. But no, she was running through wheat, mate. Outrageous. That's the sort of thing our MPs are up to. And, you know, talking to politicians, what the fuck's going on in America? I mean,
I've seen, I thought about this, and I didn't really want to drag the podcast into all the misery of it all and all the horrendous nature of it, but I did see a couple of things which I thought were quite encouraging, which was I saw a footage of one black man who was giving a very rousing speech about changing the future, and this is not how things should behave, and it was really heartwarming and heartfelt speech, and that was nice. And another really nice thing I saw was a police sheriff who greeted the protesters. He took his helmet off. He instructed all of his supporting officers to put their batons and their weapons aside, and he said, "We don't want to make this a protest. We want to make it a parade." And he walked with the protesters in solidarity, and it was really nice to see.
That's good. I mean, I want to make it clear that I'm all for the protest, by the way. I think
absolutely,
people are very within their rights to protest. You know, George Floyd, from all the footage I've seen, it seems, you know, there's obviously going to be a court case, so we can't say too much, but it looks bad. That's all you can say, I think, at the moment. Yep. Legally, I don't understand the looting and the violence. I don't understand that, but I think there's an absolute right to protest, and we should all be angry. We should all be furious at the whole situation in the States. But let's not get into that, because I think people come to this podcast for a bit of light relief, Ben.
Yeah, do they?
And I feel I
failed. I knew there was a reason they came.
I feel I've failed people in the first few minutes here. So shall
we lighten the mood?
Let's lighten the mood. I'll tell you what has cheered me up this week.
Go on.
The one shining light, literally shining light this week, was the SpaceX launch.
Oh, wasn't it incredible?
Now, I was very disappointed on Wednesday when it was it Wednesday? Yeah, when it was first meant to launch and then was delayed because of the weather.
Yeah.
And then Saturday, I watched the build-up for about an hour and a half before the launch, and I was getting so excited and nervous as the countdown was going on, and even you were getting into it. I was getting texts from you to tell you, were saying it's exciting.
It really was exciting, but then you put the fear of God into me.
Why?
Well, because I suddenly started realizing how many, God knows, hundreds of tons of fuel that, yeah, these two blokes are sitting on. And at one point, I'm sure there's a scientific answer for it, but at one point smoke seemed to be billowing out the side of the thing minutes before takeoff. And I thought, can that be right?
I think it's just coolant steam. Don't worry about it. It's fine. Okay. That's not a problem.
And then I asked you about my safety concerns.
Yeah.
And you told me that they've got very good ejector seats. So if anything goes...
Well, it's not just ejector seats. I mean, the whole top of the thing jettisons off with them in it.
But then you said they should be fine.
Well, I mean,
it's the least reassuring thing to hear when you're sitting in a rocket full of fuel. And how on earth would you have time to react if that thing went up in flames in a second?
Well, I don't know. They're trained. These guys are trained so well. But, you know, I think they'll be able to... How American are those names, by the way? Bob and Doug. I mean, I love that. They're the first Americans to be launched from American soil in 9 years, and they're Bob and Doug.
So you slightly managed to reassure me.
Yeah. Bob and Doug, they'd be fine. They'd be fine.
I felt slightly better after you told me that they should be fine. I thought, not the most reassuring words.
Everything's going to be A-OK.
And then you
Bob and Doug are on. They're on their A game. They're on their A game here, guys.
And you followed that message up by telling me that the previous day, an unmanned rocket in a test version had obliterated itself just exploded.
Yeah, I mean, there was that. There was that.
I was sweating with a minute to go.
Bob and Doug weren't there when that happened. So no. It was fine. Anyway, I must admit, when it went, because there is that nervousness as it went, and it was like I was watching a sporting event. I was sitting there going, go on, come on, come on, you can do it. Go, go. It was incredibly exciting.
As someone who detests Formula One, but always likes to see a good crash,
yeah.
I must admit that part of the excitement for me, and I wasn't wishing death on them or anything, but part of the excitement...
Unbelievable. Unbelievable. No,
but you must admit...
Blow up, Bob and Doug.
Well, no, you didn't want them to, but because you knew that dangerous element was there, that made it a hell of a lot more exciting to watch.
Oh, that's the adrenaline. Imagine the adrenaline that's going through them if we're just watching it. That adrenaline is flowing. But they're so cool and calm and collected. Again, balls they're trained steel. And they're just, balls of steel, totally. And I mean, they're all trained to be like that. They're just incredible human beings. I don't know. I'd love to go to space. I really would, but it would be in the future if I could ever afford it as a space tourist. I couldn't go as a trained astronaut to have that coolness and calmness because I'd be sitting there absolutely shitting myself. I mean, I'm imagining they are to a degree. You must be.
I think you'd be not human if you weren't very, very nervous.
But that was the interesting thing about Neil Armstrong. You know, he was almost a robot in his calmness. You know, there's some amazing moments, not just on the moon landing, but previous events that happened to him. Like when he was training and he was up in this contraption that was to mimic flying the Eagle LEM that was going to land on the moon. And the way they had to get it going here was that it was all unbalanced because it had to recreate flying in 1/10 gravity or whatever it is. And on one occasion, it didn't go right. And this thing was going to plummet to the ground. And with seconds to go, he ejected as this thing crashed to the ground and burst into flames. Christ. And he just got up and just walked on, went back in the office and got on with some work.
I'd have had the diva strop of a lifetime if that happened to me.
Conspiracists jumped onto that because they went, well, I mean, you know, there was no way he could have flown the LEM because look at that. I mean, he couldn't control it on Earth. But I mean, that was one event. You know, he flew lots of these things, but that's the one bit of footage that gets shown a lot because it was dramatic.
The thing that would trouble me is that you might be as calm as you like, but you're basically putting your life in other people's maths. I imagine it takes quite a lot of maths to get a rocket into the orbit.
Yeah, I mean, that's why I don't think I'm ever going to be a rocket scientist.
No, and just one decimal point in a slightly incorrect position could mean you're fucked.
There's an amazing film called Hidden Figures, which is about these black female mathematicians and computer scientists who were part of NASA in the 60s, treated not very well, by the way, because of their race and sex, of course, back in the 60s. But I think, thankfully, over the years, things got better for them. But they were so integral with their maths to getting man to the moon. And the film obviously has bits that have been changed for dramatic purposes, I'm sure. But I think there is one moment in that film where an equation is up on the board and they can't get it right. And it's because of a decimal point out the way. And, you know, it's a crucial bit of maths that's being done. And, my head can't deal with that sort of stuff.
No, but, I mean, I was so happy to see that thing go up without... At one point, there was a slightly confusing camera angle where I don't know what was happening, whether it was already in orbit and orbit was starting to take effect, but I thought at one point, hang on a minute, this thing's on the piss, this thing's tilting.
Well, no, it does, because it very quickly, they do roll, as they call it, and then it changes its trajectory very quickly. Because it's really weird, when I saw the space shuttle launch, when you see it go up, it then very quickly rolls and then sort of, it looks like it's sort of coming down again.
Yes, that was exactly the thing I saw. I thought, hang on, this is no longer just on the piss. This thing is plummeting back towards Earth.
But what it is, or this is what I'm led to believe, is because it's traveling at such humongous speed that by the time it's its trajectory has changed. So to our eyes, it looks like it's coming back down.
Yes.
But it's up so high that it's then sort of following the curve of the Earth. So when you see it go into the distance, it looks like it's coming down. But actually, it's so high that it's not coming down. But it looks as though it is.
I've been such an amateur as well, and I want to thank you, by the way, for all your patience in dealing with all my idiotic questions regarding.
I mean, it's not to say what I've told you is the truth; it's just what I assume.
And it all sounded very plausible.
Well, that's the main thing, isn't it? As long as it sounds plausible, and then I watched all the docking. That was exciting. I mean, that was it.
Was it?
No, don't you dare!
Because
don't you dare!
I watched it. Yeah. You said, "Oh, it's docking! It's docking!" And I flicked it on the NASA YouTube live stream.
Yeah.
And after about 10 minutes, I thought I was watching the wrong thing because piss all was happening.
Well, no, it might appear that piss all is happening, but a lot's going on there.
Well, no, it wasn't. I mean, I'm sure like calculations were happening. And
it's travelling at, you know, we talked about it last week. At that point, it was travelling at about, you know, whatever it is, 17,200 miles an hour. So it's flying bloody fast. It looks stationary because the space station is moving at the same speed.
Well, that was another one of my schoolboy errors because to my eyes, it looked like it was absolutely stationary. And I thought, why aren't they moving?
Yeah.
And then you said, well, because the camera is mounted on the International Space Station, which is also moving.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
They are both moving, but it just looks like they're not.
And it was only when it put its boosters on or whatever it does to then get nearer. And the docking process, that was exciting as well because it's down to millimetres, isn't it? That was exciting. The only thing I found slightly frustrating was waiting for the hatch to open because it was hours after the docking. And
right.
And it got to the point where I was sort of flicking back on and then watching something else and flicking back on. And they kept saying they should open the hatch in about 10 minutes and then it didn't happen. And you go, what are they waiting for? They're waiting for the pressurized bits to equalize so that, yeah, it's important stuff. But then the last bit just went on and on because they couldn't get a fucking microphone to work. I thought,
God.
Such an Earth problem. We have that problem.
I am staggered that the same people who managed to successfully launch a rocket have been baffled by a microphone. So one of my highlights from the week, following on from the SpaceX launch, was the following day, going outside at the right sort of time, about 10:13 p.m. or whatever it was, and gazing around the night sky and eventually successfully spotting the ISS floating by.
I know, that's exciting, isn't it? I've been watching it quite a lot, as we talked about last week, and this week it hasn't been quite as bright as it was last week, but it's still a real buzz I get from seeing it.
Again, though, even last night when we were talking about it, you were explaining to me that the visibility also depends on which angle the reflective panels are pointing towards the sun, and much more complicated. I shouldn't be surprised that it's complicated. It's
did you
a giant
just think it flies over and it's got a light on it?
I kind of did. Yeah.
But someone's shining a torch out the window.
Yeah, someone's left the bathroom light on in the ISS so we can all see them.
No, it's a little bit more complicated than that. And then, of course, on, was it Sunday? What day are we? That must have been Saturday night. You could actually I missed the space station, but I'm pretty sure I saw the SpaceX rocket for a very brief moment before it disappeared behind clouds.
Right.
So there is something so exciting about it all. You know, just
the one thing I did have a bit of a problem with was that I had to sort of venture out of my house, and I decided that the best place to see would be the sort of garage area where all the cars are parked.
Oh,
so
yeah,
I went round there. And I was searching around, and I was staring at a star for quite a long time, which I thought might have been it. But then I saw what definitely was it, and
right,
I was
yeah.
just dumb luck, lucky enough to be facing
did you not think,
in the right direction.
I mean, how long were you looking at the star?
Probably about a minute.
Oh, well, that's fair enough. But I mean, were you thinking, wow, it's moving very slowly, it doesn't appear to be moving?
Yeah. But I came up with quite a scientific way of discovering if it was moving or not.
Okay, what did you do?
I basically, this is going to sound really weird, but I aligned my eyesight with an antenna on somebody's roof.
Oh, clever, clever.
And I thought, right, I'll position the star or ISS just to the right-hand side of it and I won't move.
Yeah.
and sadly needed the star. So I quickly conclude that wasn't it.
Yeah. But then when you actually saw it, when it actually came into view, did your heart skip a beat? Did you feel excited? It was like, wow, there it is.
Well, I felt very lucky to have seen
Mrs.
it.
Mrs. Ben, come and have a look.
I felt very lucky to have seen it, and I enjoyed watching it go across. But for the sort of 3 or 4 minutes I was standing there watching, I did sort of think, for anyone looking out their bedroom window right now,
fuck them.
They're going to think there is definitely a peeping Tom lurking in the garages.
It's part of the reason my mate won't. He's got a fucking super duper telescope, right? This is one that's got a stand and it points directly up. Do you know what I mean? It's not a peeping Tom's bit of kit. So I keep saying to him, don't worry about it. No one's going to think you're looking in their window with this.
You could always make a real big song and dance about it, though. If you were worried that people would think it, you could camp out there for hours before.
Yeah.
So you're in plain sight.
And talk very loudly about, I'm looking forward to seeing the stars tonight.
Yes, and put some sort of NASA bunting up and, maybe put leaflets through people's doors, inviting them to come and
get
see
a CD
through your telescope.
Of Patrick Moore's talks very loudly. Rerun old episodes of Sky at Night.
And then secretly point the thing at the best-looking woman's bathroom window.
Unbelievable. Unbelievable. No, you got to use it for the... You know, if you want to look in someone's window, mate, climb a tree and use binoculars, like the old-fashioned way. It's the best way of being a peeping Tom. I've seen it in the films, I know, but if you're looking at stars, you've got to look at it properly. You know, I'm trying to learn. I want to learn about, you know, the sky properly. I've been I've got a book that Patrick Moore wrote that I was given, and I've had a flick through it, but I keep trying to learn what I'm looking, because I don't really know what I'm looking at. I look up and I know certain stars. Well, I know one. I can tell you where Venus is, I think, and the plow. I think I sort of know where that is, but apart from that, I'm fucked. So I'm trying to learn, because did you know that I've got a bit of a connection with the late great Patrick Moore?
Yes, I remember you. He was once very nice and joined you for a hoax, didn't he?
An April Fool's prank, years ago, when I was doing hospital radio before I knew you, and I did this prank, and the whole idea was that my friend played a nurse who worked at the hospital who was an amateur astronomer and had discovered a new planet. And NASA had given her the great privilege of naming it, and she was going to name it after the hospital, right? So I got her to play that. I got another friend of mine who's been on the show, Gareth Sturdy. He played an expert from the Greenwich Observatory. And I thought, it needs something else. I'd recorded it all, and I thought, it needs something else. So Patrick Moore, bless him, he was... like he wasn't a celeb in those terms where like privacy was a thing, because his phone number was easily available, right?
That's amazing.
But I didn't have the balls to just phone him. That I couldn't. I wanted to, but I couldn't. So I wrote him a letter and said, like, I'm planning this. Would you take part? And literally within 48 hours, I picked my mobile up and there was an answer phone message from him. Hello? Patrick Moore? Yes, love to. And he did. He got involved and he backed the whole thing. And the local press got involved and he was very good. He did an interview with them. I mean, they sort of made out that it was his idea, but, you know, that's fine.
So hang on, he's a spreader of fake news and a thief.
But a legend. Of course, one thing we've been doing on the podcast during the lockdown phase is play a little game. I'm quite enjoying the game, so I think we might continue with a game of some sort.
Yeah, well, I have famously been not the biggest fan, to say the least, of these games, but I know which game we're playing this week, and I'm very pleased because it's one of my favourites.
Yeah, it was a game we used to do on the radio. I think on the radio we called it Beat the Cheat.
Yes.
It's essentially true or false.
That's pithy, that, isn't it?
No, I think we nicked it from a Radio 4 thing as well that they do. So it's by no means original, but we used to have great fun doing it. So we thought, well, let's do it. And it's of course a game you can play at home, true or false. You can just find some facts and or make some stuff up. So
I should point out as well, for anyone who did happen to hear it on the radio and is thinking, oh God, it's not going to go on as long as it could go on for days on the radio. This,
oh,
but we've
honestly,
shortened it.
When it got longer and longer, didn't it?
I know.
I mean, it started off, I think the first week we did it on the radio, it lasted about 5 minutes. And then you would come in, I mean, I'd end up writing shitloads, but you would come in with like a book. and we used to do it on a Friday in an hour where we had to get something else in. We had the sports master as well, our old mate Paul Burrell.
Yeah.
And we'd just be, like, that hour was just so packed. But who gave a shit about the music in the end?
It's like, well, certainly not us.
Yeah, and it was a Friday, so it's like, fuck it, do what we want. So anyway, we're going to revive it. So you've got five facts for me. Now, on the radio, we used to give each other a subject, but this week we just thought anything. They can be on anything. So you've got five facts for me, some true, some false, and all I've got to do is guess what's true and false, right?
Yeah, that's right. Are you ready to play?
All right, let's do it, yeah.
Okay, well, here comes your first fact, or is it fact? Government professor Jonathan Van Tam, who you may have seen recently on the daily coronavirus briefings, has the middle name Claude.
Claude Van Tam. I can't believe this.
Why not? Because it
seems like a bit of an open goal, this one. You've been watching it, you've heard them go, now here's Mr. Van Tam. And I bet every time you say to Mrs. Ben, well, Claude, hey? Claude, hey? And,
well, you know, it could be. There are stranger things that have happened in this world. When, Jonathan Van Tam's middle name could be Claude.
It could be, but I'm saying it's not.
And you would be absolutely right. That is 100% bollocks. Sadly, he is not Jean-Claude Van Damme.
I mean, I hope that from now on he will be called that anyway.
Yeah. Oh, God, I really... You know when you write something and you think, oh, I wish it was true.
Yeah, yeah. Never mind.
It's probably not an original joke anyway, but there you go. Right, you know, second one. In 2005, a fortune cookie company called Wonton Food Inc. correctly foretold lottery numbers, resulting in 110 winners and an investigation. However, no fraud was involved.
Ooh,
I know.
So hang on. So inside each fortune cookie were lottery numbers. Is this what we're saying?
Yes, the exact lottery numbers.
And it was the same numbers in a lot of cookies?
Yep, resulting in 110 people using those numbers and 110 people winning the lottery.
Well, I mean, as unlikely as it sounds, mathematically...
Hang on a minute, you thought Jean-Claude Van Tam
was... Yeah, but that was bullshit. I mean, from the moment you opened your mouth on that one, I could smell it. Do you know what I mean? But on this one, there's something about this. Mathematically, that's possible. If part of that fortune, the Wonton fortune cookie companies... You know,
Wonton Food Inc. Thank you.
Food Inc. If one of their things is to put lottery numbers, there is a chance those numbers could come up. There's a chance that, I mean, the only thing is 110. I don't know one person who's taken anything from a fortune cookie seriously. but depending on where it is, it might be. I'm going to say true. I'm going to go true on this.
You're doing very well. That is true.
Oh, get in.
Investigated and no fraud was detected. It was just one of those strange coincidences.
It's not a strange coincidence, mate. It's fortune telling.
Right, number three.
Yeah.
In 1969, a musician named Jim Sullivan recorded an album called UFO, which featured strange lyrics about leaving his family and being abducted by aliens. Mm. Sullivan disappeared 6 years later without a trace, the only piece of evidence being his abandoned car found on a desert road.
Well, UFO, the album.
Are you familiar?
No, I'd love to hear it. It's a sort of thing that would have, this is ground control to Major Tom. I mean, I know it's David Bowie, but... So hang on.
The added question you've got to ask yourself is, has Ben constructed this whole thing? Has the space theme been in his mind this week?
Well, that's it. I mean, the thing is, I'm very happy to accept there's a guy called Tom Sullivan.
Jim Sullivan.
Jim Sullivan.
Thanks for paying attention.
Jim Sullivan. Well, I mean, there's so much bullshit coming my way. It's hard to keep up. Jim Sullivan existed and he made an album, but then disappeared without... So he's never been found.
Never been found. A body apparently may have been discovered, but it was confirmed to not be him. Or is that another lie?
I'm going to go true.
Are you sure?
Yeah, I am.
It is true.
Oh, I had something about it. Yeah.
Okay. Number four. You're doing exceptionally well.
I know.
Three for three. Number four. The first Monopoly World Championship had to be abandoned.
Who's attended that? Who's going to the Monopoly World Championships?
The first Monopoly World Championship.
That means there was a second one.
I mean, had to be. Listen, we have to get to the end of it. You can scrutinise it afterwards. The first Monopoly World Championship had to be abandoned after accusations of cheating erupted in the semi-finals, which led to the accused player flipping the board and brawling with his opponent.
Wow. I'm willing to believe there's a Monopoly World Championship because, you know, there's things like the Worm Charming World Championship. So there's bound to be a Monopoly World Championship. Having a hissy fit and flipping the board. Had you have just said it had to have been abandoned because of accusations of cheating, I could get that. But I think it's the petulant act of a child. Losing
Monopoly is a particularly frustrating game when you're losing.
Well, I remember you telling me that your father-in-law put the board outside or something. I can't quite remember the story.
Oh, he employed some expertise methods of cheating.
Yeah.
He was an expert.
But didn't he put it outside? He'd had enough for... I'm sure there was some tale you told me. Anyway.
No, what he did was he put the back, because we were all watching him like a hawk because of his reputation of cheating, and he had the bank very near to the back door. And what he would do was he would then pretend he would go to the toilet, and we'd all think, okay, fine, you can't cheat if you're not in the room.
Yeah.
And then what he'd do is he'd sneak round the back of the house, and a hand would come in through the back door and help itself to the bank, and none of us clocked it. It was genius.
Wow. Okay. Well, how long did he get away with it for?
Well, we never caught him. Well, he just eventually one day revealed his various methods of cheating.
No
he was quite
way.
Proud of his cheating.
Wow, okay. Well, I'm going to go a lie on this because I would accept there might have been accusations of cheating, but flipping the board, no.
There have well been Monopoly championships held.
Yeah.
But this was rubbish.
Now, Full House is in the offing here.
You could get a potential 5 out of 5 if you can get this final one right. Are you ready?
Here we go.
In 1985, to promote their make-or-break first-ever WrestleMania event, the WWF sent Hulk Hogan for a joint promotion with McDonald's. Whilst there, Hogan challenged the Hamburglar to an impromptu press-up competition without knowing the man inside the suit was a personal trainer and a fitness expert. Hogan lost, and the WWF demanded McDonald's wipe the footage, which has never been seen to this day.
Oh, now, this is interesting. I mean, this is hard because I can see this happening. I can see Hulk Hogan or all the, you know, any wrestler, the massive egos that go on in that.
And WrestleMania 1 was a very big deal. It was a very big gamble for the WWF at the time. They couldn't afford it to be embarrassed or go wrong.
It's the thing about wiping the tape. But if there's so much money riding on it. Now, were McDonald's a massive sponsor of the WWF? Is that what you were saying?
I don't know if they were a sponsor. It was a joint promotion. So I imagine it would have been... So I don't know what was going on. I imagine it would have been Hulk Hogan promoting a Big Mac and then in turn they're promoting the WWF.
Now, what year would this have been? WWF?
1985.
1985.
For WrestleMania 1. But you can fact check that if you'd like.
No, I trust you. You know, you're not Donald Trump. now, if... in 1985, big deal. Hulk Hogan would have been like the jewel in the crown for WWF then. So just have him lose to a man in a... Hamburglar suit would have been not good. So I'm going to go true on it. I think that's probably true.
I'm sorry to tell you, it's absolutely false.
No.
Hulk Hogan did not lose a press-up competition to the Hamburglar.
I want to share something with you that I was sent this week.
Okay.
It's a list of London's rudest street names.
Right.
Now, we've talked about place names, haven't we? Like Pratt's Bottom.
Yeah, I think there's a place called Twat.
Is there a place called Twat?
Yeah.
Yeah. That's Downing Street. So, I love stuff like this. So I've been sent this list of 23 of the rudest street names in London. Are you ready for some of these?
Yes, go ahead.
Some of them are very straightforward. Some of them you got to think about a little bit more, maybe. So we'll do it in no particular order here. Cold Blow Lane.
Okay.
I mean, you know, read into that what you want. Cummings Street.
I thought that was in Durham.
Clitter House Road.
Oh, yes, that's, yes, yeah. Very good.
Balls Pond Road.
That's not that good, is it? It's just got the word balls in it.
Balls in it, yeah. Back Passage in the City of London.
I like that one.
Cock Pond.
Is that near Balls Pond?
Yeah, I think it's just above it.
Yeah, adjacent.
Adjacent? You might want to see a doctor. Cock Lane.
Right.
Helmet Row. White Knobs Way.
Right.
I'll just give you a couple more. Peckerman's Wood.
Again, not the strongest.
No. The Butts and Upper Butts in Brentford.
Okay.
I don't think London does very well with rude place names, does it? But I think there are other places around the country that have better names. I mean, there's a place near Torquay called Cockermouth. Fanny Hands Lane.
No, there isn't.
Yeah, that's in London. Fanny Hands. Lane. Yeah. Horny Old Road.
Horny Old Road.
Horny Old Road.
That's got to be a dogging spot, isn't it?
it's in Worcestershire, quite possibly. I don't know why I said that. But Jackass Lane. There's another one for you.
That's a good one.
Fingering Hoe, of course.
Fingering Hoe.
Well, it's a famous place in Essex, isn't it?
Oh, Essex.
Yeah, no, I'm not making that up.
I'm saying nothing.
It is in Essex. What else have we got here? Cockshoot Close.
Cockshoot Close. Well, it's fair to warn them, isn't it?
Now, I spoke to you in the week, Ben, and you... I said to you, so what are you going to do for the rest of your day? And you said, I'm just about to go on YouTube and watch some more foodie stuff.
Yeah, I've been absolutely binging on it recently.
Have you actually been making any of the stuff you've been watching?
I've made a burrito, which I saw. I haven't been doing too much cooking. I've been a bit lazy, really. It's been mainly just stuff you throw in the oven recently. For all my foodie love, I haven't really been bothered to get off my arse recently.
I hear that my brother is apparently taking up baking during the lockdown. He's been watching a lot of cookery programs and has been trying his hand at stuff. I was sent a little bit of his bread pudding the other day. It was very good. It was very good, yeah. I was a bit gutted I missed out on his... what did he tell me he'd made? I think it's a Heston Blumenthal thing.
Oh, blimey. How long did that take him?
Well, I think it was a fairly straightforward. It was a 6-egg toad in the hole.
Because normally most of Heston Blumenthal's recipes are more complicated than
this.
Well,
you need a fucking science lab, don't you, to do this stuff? Yeah, because normally he's got like ejaculating volcanic puddings. Doesn't he?
We tend to use the word erupting with volcanoes rather than ejaculating.
Well, no, I'm sure once I saw him and he was offering an ejaculating pudding, that might have been a place. I don't know. But here's a couple of food things. One that's caused a bit of a stir this week online, which is to do with the English breakfast.
Oh, I think I'm aware of this.
So, the English breakfast. Now, what would you say are the key ingredients of the good traditional English breakfast?
Egg.
Egg, yeah.
Bacon.
Bacon, yeah.
Baked beans.
Yeah.
A variety of egg, as in scrambled, fried, or however you want it. Mushroom.
Yeah.
Bit of toast.
Yeah.
That'll probably do it.
So, what, no sausage for you? You're not sticking the sausage?
Oh, how could I forget the sausage? Yes, have a sausage, definitely.
Okay. And what about, like, you know, hash brown or anything like that?
Yeah, happy to throw a hash brown in there, yeah.
Peas?
Maybe even a bit of roasted tomato. Peas? Yeah. No, absolutely not.
Well, this is what someone has caused an uproar with this week by putting peas with her full English breakfast.
I once had to defend myself on the radio for putting sweet corn in a roast dinner.
That's right, yeah.
And I feel like that wasn't that controversial, but people got very upset with me over it. But peas on a full English is, there's just no place for it.
I would say it would be fine. I mean, it's not a breakfast food, I'll give you that. But if you were doing like a brunch, right, it's fine, but not with beans as well. I think you've got to have one or the other. She's got them both going on there, and I don't know if you can do that.
I'd say by all means, eat what you want, cook what you want, but don't call it a full English breakfast. The moment those peas hit the plate, you've made a bastard. It's no longer a full English breakfast.
Is there like an official... I bet there's an official English breakfast sort of organisation.
I know there's an official hot dog organisation.
Yeah, so I'm going to look up. I'm going to find out because, you know, there might be rules on what you can and can't have. And what can, you know, like you can only call champagne champagne if it comes from the Champagne region.
That's correct. Otherwise, it's Prosecco or it's sparkling wine or something. Yeah,
yeah, yeah. Sparkling wine because Prosecco comes from somewhere else,
Italy,
isn't it?
Yeah,
yeah. So, but I wonder if like there's a rule. Like it's the same with Melton Mowbray pork pies, isn't it? You know, you can only call them that if they're from there. So the
And Cornish pasties, they're very strict laws on that. I say laws, they probably aren't laws, but
rules. No, I think they are. It's, I mean, I don't know what sort of punishment would be meted out. But, you know.
Meted out. Nice pun.
Right. So
just while you look that up, I should add in as well that there is the optional blood pudding, which I think is popular with some people, but really does nothing for me. I say that, but I've never tried it.
The Irish breakfast, if you're in Ireland, you get black pudding and white pudding.
What the hell's white pudding?
I'm not entirely sure. I touched neither.
I'm not sure I want to know.
I did try the white pudding. I tried the first time because black pudding, if that's on the plate, I don't go anywhere near it because it's just...
Oh, you mean you don't find the idea of a nice disc of clotted pig's blood appetising?
I don't know.
No, funny, no. Neither do I.
And I think white pudding is just as disgusting. I'm going to that's another thing I've got to look up now, what white pudding is. I mean, white pudding is, I think, is basically stomach, or it'll be something fucking disgusting, won't it?
You know, some podcasters do their research beforehand. We like to do it as we record.
So white pudding is a meat dish popular in Scotland, Ireland, Northumberland, all kinds of places, similar to black pudding but doesn't include blood. It's not too bad. It's only got suet, oatmeal, breadcrumbs, and in some cases, pork and pork liver. But that's it.
That's not too bad.
So it's not too bad. So I've tried it, but I must say, whenever I've been in Ireland, and that's cut, I leave it. I'm not interested. Not interested in it at all. Right, I've found the English Breakfast Society.
Okay. And do they have advice or rules?
I don't know. You can become a member.
What a pointless thing to do.
There's a fry-up inspector. I guess that's somebody just goes around looking at
basically
them.
Doing what we're doing now.
Yeah, there doesn't seem to be any rules. I can't read it all now. Obviously, as you say, most people would bother looking up beforehand, but I've got better things to do. So yeah, that's the English breakfast. No peas, basically, is what we're saying. Now, here's another one that I know you're going to find controversial, and okay. I know that you won't like it before I've even started, but give it a go. Now, well, no, let's start. You like a good roast potato, right?
I do, yeah.
How'd you get your roast potato nice and crispy? Because that's the best way, isn't it? Crispy when you get into it, soft in the middle.
Oh, God, I don't want to get too boring about it, but I would say parboil the potatoes, Drain them, steam them, give them a little shake so they tuft up a little bit.
Bit of flour
in a pan of... optional. Not necessary, but optional. Throw them in the pan with some oil, and then off they go.
But a bit of Marmite over the top.
What?
Bit of Marmite over the top?
No.
Yeah. One chef has said it gives it a nice, crispy, shiny exterior. So when you put it in your pan, you drizzle some Marmite over it, and then halfway through, you drizzle some more.
What qualifications does this chef have?
Well, it's just like an online foodie. I mean, anyone cooks these days, don't they? You know?
I would give them the benefit of the doubt as far as I would try it, and if it made for a crunchier, tastier roast potato, then I would say, you know, fuck me, you were right. But if it tastes in any way of Marmite, you've ruined your roast potatoes.
Well, I don't know if it'll taste Marmite-y. You're only putting a bit over it. I don't think you... I mean, by the time you put gravy on and stuff... Because some people put a bit of Marmite in their gravy. So,
that's,
you know...
insane.
No, a little spoonful of Marmite in your gravy. Just mix it in. Oh, a lovely, nice little tang of Marmite in... Not that I've ever done it, but I've seen people do it.
I just don't understand. If you like the taste of Marmite, why are you bothering to make a roast? Just have Marmite on toast. I don't understand.
Yeah, it's fucking lovely, isn't it? Marmite on toast.
Vile.
Okay, it's time for my round of the true or false game, or beat the cheat, whatever we're calling this particular game.
And you've got a high score to beat. It's going to be tricky, this, because you scored 4 out of 5.
Yeah, okay. Now, I've approached this slightly differently to you.
Okay.
What I've done is I've come up with more than 5 facts, but I'll only do 5, okay?
Okay.
And I've gone along the the subjects from Trivial Pursuit.
Oh, very good. Okay.
But what I'm going to do is, do you remember when we had Jace Patrick on a few weeks ago? I had the random selector generator.
Yes.
That's back.
Oh, no.
So
please remember to be consistent with it this time.
Well, no.
Not just all over the shop.
So it'll come up with the first subject. Oh, it's entertainment.
Very good.
Right, yes. So entertainment, here's your first fact for entertainment. In the making of the film Rocky IV, Sylvester Stallone wanted to make sure that the boxing scenes looked as real and authentic as possible. So he instructed Dolph Lundgren to really hit him. And I mean really hit him. At one point, Lundgren punched Stallone so hard in the chest, old Sly ended up in intensive care for 4 days.
Now, I don't know really what the spirit of the game is. Am I allowed to ask follow-up questions, or is that not really the rules?
Well, ask the question. I'll decide whether I'll answer it.
Okay. I'd like to know with what he was hospitalised with, but what damage had been done.
I'm not going to answer that.
Now, I don't know if you're not answering because you've made it up and you can't lie well on the spot, or if you just don't know the answer.
Well, that's for you to work out, isn't it?
I'm going to suggest it's false, purely based on the fact that you don't see many punches to the chest in boxing. You see a lot of shots to the side of the body and the ribs, and I don't see many punches to the pectoral region.
Right.
I don't think there's a lot of.
I mean, he's an actor, isn't he? He might not have known exactly what boxing was, you know.
Yeah, but if Stallone was that method, that he was willing to be punched at that force, then you would have think he would at least be method enough to get a co-star who knows how to vaguely box. So I'm going to say this is false.
It's true.
Ah!
It's absolutely true. Yeah, he got punched in the chest. Intensive care for 4 days. I'm assuming he, I don't know what he did. He must have damaged a lung or something. I don't know.
Crikey. Yeah. Idiot.
Right. You ready for your second one?
Because even real boxers don't want to be hit.
Randomly generate another subject.
Okay.
It's history. Here's your history fact. Henry VIII was a true horse lover and would gallop through the English countryside with the best mounted knights of his kingdom. When his mounts didn't listen, he cried, "Traitor! Villain!" But what many people don't know is that his key equine contribution to England was introducing the Italian sport of dressage to the masses. Now, Henry himself became adept at the sport and would perform at tournaments to raucous applause and cheering from the crowds. And he became so intoxicated by the adulation that he toiled to become better and better, and eventually became a specialist in capriolet, or great leaps, making his horse jump super high in the air as if it were flying. His appearances at events and tournaments drew huge crowds, and so it became part of the English equine culture.
Right, I'm suspecting bullshit here, because I think if you'd left it that Henry VIII had introduced dressage, I would have found that questionable on its own. certainly towards the end of his life, Henry VIII was quite a big unit, and to make a horse dance with him on top of it would have been quite a cruel thing to do. But this nonsense at the beginning about shouting traitor...
Yeah, traitor, villain,
That seemed all like completely irrelevant details that you didn't need to include. So I think you're guilty of talking too much. I think this is false.
It's true.
Oh, for fuck's sake, I've lost my touch in this game.
Yeah, Henry VIII introduced dressage to this country. Incredible.
So who was he shouting villain and traitor at for doing what?
It was the horses. If the horses didn't do what he wanted, he would call them traitors and villains.
Oh, I thought he was shouting at his knights. That's probably just as well I didn't, because if I thought he was shouting at the horses, that would have really cemented it with rubbish in my mind, but obviously it's true.
Right, ready for the next one?
I'm not sure.
We're generating another category.
I've already lost.
It's art and literature.
Okay.
Okay.
So I'm playing for pride now.
Here's your
consolation goals.
Art and literature fact. The Mona Lisa situated in Le Louvre in Paris, is possibly the world's most famous painting. One of the painting's characteristics, hotly debated by experts, is her lack of eyebrows. Now, some claim the subject's lack of eyebrows is representative of high-class fashion of the time. Others insist it's proof that the Mona Lisa is an unfinished masterpiece. However, in notes written by Da Vinci discovered in 1953, he wrote, "It was my desire for the model to remain mysterious. I therefore instructed her to shave her eyebrows that no viewer could gauge or explain her thoughts or emotions." And that's why, to this day, along with her enigmatic smile, she continues to be interpreted so differently by everyone who views her.
Okay, so... well, this is you've thrown in many true facts here. The Mona Lisa is a very famous painting.
Painting in the Louvre.
It's held in the Louvre in France. However, unless I've been sold a complete lie, I understood that the reason the Mona Lisa had no eyebrows was because they had been lost due to art restoration. Although... now I'm questioning everything in life.
Well, remember they found these notes in 1953, so fairly recently.
I'm going to say it's a lie.
Yeah, it's a lie. Yeah.
Oh, thank God.
Yeah, completely. The first bit's true.
So do we know why she has no eyebrows?
Some say it is the lack of eyebrows is representative of high-class fashion of the time. Others insist it's proof that the Mona Lisa is an unfinished masterpiece. But the truth is exactly what you said. They were there once. They just disappeared. Right, you ready for the next one?
It's, yep, ready.
Oh, here we go. It's sport.
It's irritating, that thing.
Right. The annual university boat race between Oxford and Cambridge began in 1856. For many years, as it was generally those from the aristocracy who competed, they had servants known as oar keeps, who would look after and maintain their oars. It was tradition that the oar keeps of the losing team, on returning to the university camps, would be pelted with rotten fruit as a punishment for not maintaining the oars, leading to the defeat. The oar keeps were then known as old fruits till the following year, and that phrase old fruit is still used now as a term of endearment. The practice was discontinued following the First World War, as servants had fought on the same battlefield as rowers, and hence a new mutual respect was formed. Oar keeps became obsolete during the years of the Depression in the 1930s.
It's a very interesting story. I don't know why oar keep would become a term of endearment.
No, not oar keep, old fruit.
Oh, sorry, old fruit. I don't know why that would become a term of endearment.
Have you never heard that, when people call you an old fruit?
No.
My old fruit?
I've never heard that.
I've been called that by people. How are you, my old fruit? I'm all right.
I also find it quite strange that they would naturally assume, whilst pelting them with rotten fruit, that it was because of their... incompetence that the rowers had lost. Maybe they just weren't good enough.
Well, it was the part of the class structure. That's right. You know, you had the aristocracy.
So it's the upper class thinking, blame anyone but us.
Yeah, yeah. Times have changed, haven't they?
I'm going to say this is also false.
Yeah, it's a lie. Right, one more. Let's get your last one up. And it is science and nature.
Okay.
Right, you're ready for your science and nature fact.
Let's go.
In 2013, it was discovered by scientists that diamonds fall like rain on Saturn and Jupiter. Atmospheric data indicates that carbon is abundant in its crystal form. According to scientists, lightning storms turn methane into soot or carbon, which as it falls hardens into chunks of graphite and then diamond. The biggest diamonds would likely be about a centimetre in diameter, and it's thought that 1,000 tonnes of diamonds a year are being created on Saturn alone. However, these diamond hailstones eventually melt into a liquid sea in the planet's hot core.
I instantly think this is rubbish, because diamonds, I do know, take... I don't know about thousands, but hundreds of years to form on Earth.
Especially space, mate. You know, the laws of physics are very different.
I think if it's like Dick Whittington, isn't it, where he thinks London streets are paved with gold. I think if the streets of Jupiter were paved with diamonds, I think Elon Musk would have been straight up there.
Well, no, you can't, because you can't land on Jupiter. It's a gas planet, so you couldn't go and collect them.
Oh, he'd have got a big net by now. He'd have done something to get all those diamonds. So based on the fact that they take thousands of years, I think you've actually done exactly what I thought you might have thought I'd done earlier on, which is been influenced by a bit of space talk this week.
Yeah.
I've made up some appropriate spacey bollocks.
Yeah.
This is crap.
It's true.
It can't be true. Where's Elon Musk with his net?
It's absolutely true. So what did you get there? How many did you get? Your one, two, did you get three? I think you got three in the end.
Two, no, or
you
three. Got
two. You got two.
Yeah, I didn't do very well. I had fun, though.
Well, there we are. That's about it for another Trev and Ben podcast. Just before we go, our normal recommendations. Been watching or listening or playing anything good this week, Ben?
A friend of mine recommended a wrestling-based podcast, which I know won't be for everybody, but I've started listening to that. It's called The Vicious Circle. It's all about the life and career of wrestler Sid Vicious, who probably won't be to everyone's taste or interest, but if you're a wrestling nerd like me, then that's a good one.
Okay, all right. Well, I haven't been watching much new this week. I did see a really good drama on BBC Two called 54 Hours, The Gladbeck Hostage Crisis, and that was
that
a two-part drama in German about this crisis, this hostage crisis that happened in the 1980s. It's quite an incredible watch. The other thing I would recommend watching, just from a historical standpoint, is on the BBC iPlayer at the moment, they've got an episode of Panorama from a few days after man landed on the moon. And it's just it's not all the normal science stuff. They talk about all kinds of social and economic ramifications. And it's just really interesting to watch because they discuss sort of where technology might take us in the future. And you kind of see things that are happening now that they kind of refer to. But it's what's interesting is there's this one woman on the panel who's amazing, lady something. They all talk very posh, you know. But this woman, she's saying, you know, we should be spending money on space because it was, you know, controversial to a degree the amount of money they spent on the moon landings. And she was saying, no, we should be spending that instead of all the nuclear, you know, missiles that are being created, all the war. And even then, people were terrified of where we're at. Think, nothing's changed. So it's just a fascinating watch.
That sounds good. Speaking of watching, I would like to just go back and address, I have been carrying on watching Fawlty Towers.
Oh, yes, good. Be. I've been watching a few. You got me back into it.
And I watched, I think, what is widely known as one of the best episodes, which is Communication Problems.
Oh, amazing episode.
It was certainly funny and it was very well written, but my God, is it racist?
There's a lot of racism in
I'm baffled that Netflix haven't edited that out or anything, but there it is in all its horrible glory.
Yeah.
But so be warned, it does contain all its original racism.
Yes, no, there's moments in those old sitcoms, and 40 Hours is definitely one of them, where there's language. I'd be surprised if the BBC would show them now in their full unedited versions.
I doubt it.
I very much doubt it. The other thing just to recommend is we had Jace Patrick on a few weeks back. He's one of the voices on Scissors 7, which is on Netflix, and the new dubbed version with his voice on is now available.
Fantastic. So if you haven't already seen it, go and watch it, but make sure you listen to the dubbed version with our mate Jace.
And just before we go, talking to Jace, he got in touch this week because he enjoyed last week my little bit of singing.
Yeah.
Didn't he? I really enjoyed Trev singing that hippie old song, Hurdy-Gurdy Mushroom Man. And I think it went down well. And he said he'd like to hear more. So I thought I'd finish today with a little rendition of another little song. Have you ever heard of a song called The Lightning Tree?
Can we sorry, just to interrupt you, mate. Can we edit out Jace's little mention there? Because
No.
If he's going to do this to me, I think we should we shouldn't give him a plug. Look, fuck him.
Look, all I'm doing is giving the people what they want. You know what I mean? It's a democracy,
right?
We've had the feedback; they want more of it.
Just get it out of the way.
The Lightning Tree by a band called The Settlers. I know someone who was in the band. They were big in the 60s, and they had a song called The Lightning Tree, and it sort of went, down in the meadow where the wind blows free, in the middle of a field stands a lightning tree, his limbs all torn from the day it was born, for the tree was born in a thunderstorm. Grow, grow, the lightning tree, it's never been too late for you and me. Grow, grow, the lightning tree, never give in too easily.
I can almost hear
down
people
in the meadow
turning
where
off.
The wind blows like I'm
just down to just Jace. Even I'll have turned off by this point.
Thank you very much for listening and downloading. Don't forget you can get in touch with us anytime at Trev and Ben on Twitter. Tell us if you want more singing. Happy to do it. Happy to do it.
Don't.
And, we'll catch you again next week. Till then, stay safe, stay well, and take it easy.
Bye.